Now, in many ways, an American presidential race is the world's biggest Rorschach test. In the amorphous shape of a candidate, voters see what they want to see. Still, there is an actual person dwelling within the political persona. The question is, how much of the distortion in the candidate's personality is due to the demands of a modern presidential campaign, and how much is due to self-distortions made by the candidate himself? Well, this time around, that question applies best to Mitt Romney. It may be the number one long-term issue dogging his campaign. I mean, who is this guy? Social conservative or political moderate? Visionary businessman or ruthless capitalist? Slick political strategist or flip-flopper? Two veteran political reporters from the Boston Globe tackle these questions head-on in a new biography entitled The Real Romney. Michael Cranish and Scott Hellman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, it's great to have you guys. It's a fascinating book. You spent 5 years reporting it. I want to ask you a little bit later what that was like. But we just heard Monica Brady Myrov down in South Carolina saying that on his stump speech in South Carolina, Mitt Romney's leaving voters feeling cold, not taking questions. And I wonder, you have a very striking quotation from one of Romney's fellow Republicans in the book saying that, quote, he has that invisible wall between me and you. So is this really a genuine part of Romney's character?
I do think it is a genuine part of his character. I think it's a big political challenge, as it has been in every race he's run. One of the things that struck us in doing the research for the book is that when you talk to people who are very close to him, they describe him as warm, funny, he's engaging, he's human, right? They sort of see this three-dimensional figure. But when you get outside that bubble, a very sort of different perception exists, and that's that he's wooden or he's detached or he's hard to connect with. Mm-hmm. And I think in South Carolina there's a particular sort of political problem there, of course, as well, because there are a lot of very socially conservative voters, and so they're going to object to him regardless, I think, of how he comes across. But I can see that, especially in the South, right, where people are friendly and they're much more engaging generally than us Northeasterners, that he could come across that way. And I think the combination of that and his sort of at least past moderate positions, I'm sure, is presenting quite a challenge for him.
Well, you recall in the book how, you know, even here in Massachusetts, there were aspects of his time as governor which really spoke to this analytical, aloof side to him. And I mean, you remember how he had a rope across the entrance to the governor's offices. And you even quote some legislators complaining that he didn't know everyone's name on Beacon Hill. So, I mean, I wonder, what did people tell you over the course of your reporting about why they think he's that way?
To some extent, this is how he has been throughout his life, I think. I mean, one of the things that we were struck by is that, you know, he has been in a series of bubbles from the time he was young. I mean, he grew up in a pretty wealthy suburb in a very tight-knit but closed Mormon community. He has this sort of brief year at Stanford University before going off on a 2.5-year Mormon mission in France. But there he's sort of, again, in his own sort of bubble around people who are like him or doing things that are like him, and then comes back to BYU, and then he's at Harvard, but not really living with, you know, other graduate students in grimy apartments in Cambridge and Somerville. He's living with his wife in Belmont and their young son. And so, you know, I do think, and then, of course, you just keep going from there, right? He's at Bain. He makes a ton of money. That makes him, I think, even more sort of separate from regular folk. So I think it continues to be a challenge for him as far as sort of where it comes from. You know, I do think a lot of it is biographical, and it also, I think, is his nature. Unlike his father, he's very reserved. He's much more reserved. He's much more diplomatic. He's much more scripted. And by most accounts, he's always been like that.
Yeah.
Right. You know, his father, George Romney, had said that he was brainwashed by the generals in Vietnam. And that one sentence is viewed by historians as having exploded George Romney's presidential ambitions. And the son does not want to fail like the father. And his sister is quoted in the book, for example, as saying that, you know, as a result of that moment, Mitt is more careful, more scripted. So you see him running what is a very cautious campaign. He's actually a very cautious person by nature. It's reported throughout the book. And you see that in the way they control the message, in the way they control access, in the way that he often does not want to take questions from the audience, as your reporter in the field reported on before our segment. So all of that really does play into the idea that people have this question about the distance between then and him and how he can connect to the average voter.
Well, Scott and Michael, you have uncovered some really fascinating and I think quite revealing stories about the moments within those bubbles, those co-centric bubbles. And one of the sort of bubbles you've described is what, you know, his real leadership and impact in the Mormon church here in Massachusetts. I mean, listeners will remember that, of course, when Mitt Romney was running for election in Massachusetts, he basically ran as a social moderate. I mean, handing out, as you reminded us, pink flyers at gay pride parades and telling women that he would support abortion rights. But you have the story of, as a church leader in the Mormon church here, he had to counsel a woman about an abortion. And this was a woman who might not have even survived the pregnancy. And it's a really revealing moment. Can you tell us what happened?
Sure. So as a bishop of his ward, which is basically means that Romney was in charge of, let's say, 400 or 500 Mormons in the Belmont area, you know, he's basically their pastor. Mormons don't have paid clergy, so they rely on people like Romney and others, other Mormons in good standing, to lead their church. So in this case, Romney was counseling a woman who had had 5 pregnancies, and this was her 6th. And she had some medical problems. She wanted to get an abortion. In all but very few circumstances, the Mormon church prohibits abortion. Romney goes to visit her and says, you know, I don't want you to have this abortion. And she's sort of pleading with him, saying, look, this is risky and my life could be at risk. And well, he's saying, my concern is for the child.
In fact, as you write it, another member of the church, another sort of church leader who was a doctor, had told the woman, in this case, yes, I mean, it's okay for you to have the abortion. But Romney obviously had a different opinion.
Right. And he sort of waved that off and said, I don't believe you. Now, we should say this was all based on this woman's account. She later wrote about this for a sort of liberal Mormon women journal. But, you know, I think it's revealing in the sense that even at a time when he was professing to be pro-choice politically, he was still very much in charge of delivering the church's message on abortion. And that message is, you know, only in very grave circumstances are you permitted to have an abortion. And in this case, the woman was, because her doctors couldn't say for sure that she would die or, you know, that there would be severe harm to the child, that was not a good enough exception and that she should not have an abortion.
Well, I wonder from your experience covering Mitt Romney, you know, both in Washington and in here in Massachusetts, how much does this story tell us about what his real, genuine social policy is on abortion? I mean, you know, as we know, he said he was going to support abortion rights in Massachusetts. Now running for president, he's turned the other way completely, reminding everyone that, yes, he is anti-abortion. So where's the truth here? Where's the real Romney?
Well, that's still a matter of great debate. I mean, if you ask people now, some people think, oh, the real Romney is the guy who was running in 94. Other people say, no, the real Romney is the one you see now, and he was faking it before. I mean, in reality, if you look back at his first political race in 1994 against Ted Kennedy, this was the first time he had to really answer these questions about what he believed and who he was, how he felt about all these social issues. And by many accounts, you know, he hadn't confronted a lot of them before, and that he had a very kind of pragmatic view of things, but which is to say that I'm not sure how strongly he actually cared about these things. Or he wasn't dogmatic about abortion or gay marriage and so forth. You know, he says, I've always been pro-life personally, and that's what my church believes. You know, and that might be true, but it's hard to distinguish sort of being pro-life personally and then pro-choice in a kind of public way, and that I think that's what's gotten him into trouble.
Well, if I can, I want to ask you something about what you've discovered about his time at Bain Capital, especially because there's so much attention on the claims that he's made regarding job creation when he was head of Bain Capital. Now, I mean, it's so fascinating. I mean, you sort of dug up numbers that show that in his 15 years there, Bain invested $260 million in his top 10 deals and reaped $3 billion in return. So, you know, just based on that balance sheet, it was a wild success. And, you know, conventional thinking is that lots of risk can bring great reward. But you also write that Mitt Romney, at his core, is basically a really risk-averse businessman. I mean, did that surprise you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. What we tried to do in the book was to really give a good sense of his 15-year career. So in the campaign, understandably, you have Mitt Romney portraying it in a soundbite in the most positive way. You have some of his opponents, Newt Gingrich, in a soundbite in the most negative way, and it becomes a distorted picture. So what we really tried to do in a full-scale biography is to tell you why he got in the business, how he got in, how he started out in a pretty pure capitalistic play of venture capital. So in other words, he's risking his and his investors' money on an entirely new venture, betting it'll work, and having a very long-term perspective, possibly 10 years down the road, for example. Mm-hmm. But he did some of those deals. He became concerned those deals were pretty risky, didn't pay off in a reasonable amount of time for his investors. And so after a somewhat short period of time, he switched to another field of finance. It's called leverage buyouts. Right. And to really understand the controversy over what he did at Bain Capital, you need to understand the two distinct boxes of his career at Bain Capital. So the first box, venture capital, they actually originally called the company Bain Venture Capital. And that's where he invested in Staples. And by now, everyone probably knows the story of how he invested in Staples as a startup, an office super supply store. And what's interesting is if you look at about 100 deals that he did, Staples is one of the smallest investments that Bain made, mm-hmm. despite all the publicity about it. They put in about $2.5 million, and they cashed out at about $13 million. It's a nice return, but it's nothing like the hundreds of millions of dollars that Bain Capital and Romney made on later deals where he really made his big money. So what's interesting is if you look at Staples, The Globe in 1994 talked about this very same issue, and he claimed credit for helping create a certain number of jobs. He said, I'm very careful to say that I always helped, quote unquote, create those jobs. And he said, quote, I don't take credit for the jobs at Staples. Fast forward to this campaign, and his campaign and him are basically saying he created over 100,000 jobs. Of those jobs, they said specifically 89,000 came from Staples. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those jobs did come after he cashed in his investment. And we talked to the founder of Staples, and that person says, well, Mitt Romney got us off the ground, so you might as well give him credit for all the jobs ever created at Staples. Other experts would say you can only take credit for the jobs that you created at a company that you ran. And Mitt Romney did not run Staples, obviously. He was an investor. So it gives you a sense that there's a little bit of a disconnect between what he did at Staples and the way it's being portrayed now. And then his later deals, leverage buyouts, are an entirely different animal that we can talk about, but yeah. a much more controversial type of deal.
Well, I wish we could get into more detail here. Unfortunately, we're running out of time and can't, but I'm going to tell listeners in a minute how they can actually hear more from you guys tomorrow. But my last question to you for this segment is, you spent 5 years working on this book and talking to dozens and dozens of people who know Romney or worked with him very well. I guess, what do you think is the one aspect of his personality that you think can best explain why his public persona is still so enigmatic to so many people?
I think it relates to this thing we were talking about earlier, Meghna, when we were talking about his he keeps everything very close, and he has this very tight circle. He's very private. There's a very revealing quote after he was in this horrible fatal accident in France as a Mormon missionary. And, you know, he was the driver of this car. A woman was killed. It was terrible. But Romney at the time was very conscious of showing the French people that he was not going to be bothered by this. So he sort of kind of suppresses any kind of emotional reaction or emotional trauma he's going through after this accident because he doesn't want to sort of project weakness, right? He doesn't mm-hmm. want to sort of show that he's being affected by this. And I think to some extent that's what he's still doing today. There's the sort of the public Mitt and the private Mitt. And you see this with other politicians, but I think it's particularly stark here when you look at how he is around people he's close to and comfortable with and how he's around everybody else. And he's just obviously not fully comfortable, you know, being himself and letting his hair down. And I think when he tries to, it sort of seems like he's trying to, you know, and it's not natural. And I think he has to fix that.
Well, the new biography is The Real Romney. It's by Scott Hellman and Michael Cranish of the Boston Globe. Scott and Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here, Meghna.
Well, listeners, as you heard, there's obviously much more to this story and much more to Michael and Scott's reporting. So you can actually hear it in person tomorrow when WBUR's Bob Oakes talks with Michael Cranish and Scott Hellman at the Boston Public Library's Author Talk Series. They'll be at the BPL's RAB Lecture Hall tomorrow night from 6 to 8 p.m. There are more details on how you can attend at our website, radioboston.org.
Coming up, a discussion about vocational high school solving the urban school challenge in Boston. Also, sports with Bill Littlefield. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.